Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Fast Pancake.
Yeah, I'm no good at subterfuge. In fact, I seriously suck at subterfuge. I would be the worst spy ever.
Worst spy ever.
Yep.
I don't feel like that's a flaw, though. I feel like when you put it that way, obviously worst spy ever sounds like it is inherently bad because
great.
It involves the word worst. But, I don't think that's so bad.
I mean, I don't think I'd be any good at killing people either, if it's any consolation.
Right. Also,
it's sort of general James Bond spy assassin kind of thing. I've got very poor spatial awareness. So this whole like...
Okay, now we're getting into more general application stuff, though.
Go into a new place and find the thing that you need to find that's going to save the world without someone specifically telling you where to go every single time. Yeah. My spy films would last a long time because most of the time I'd just be lost.
I like how we and went then, from I'd be a, I'm not very good at lying or sneaking about or killing people. Also, my sense of direction isn't great. It's like,
what can I say? I'm aware of my strengths and my weaknesses. I know a lot about poetry. I'm pretty good at words. I make a pretty good. Pretty good food, fair. You know, I can cook reasonably well.
Yeah.
I'm good fun. I know quite a bit about beer.
Yeah.
I'm a good teacher.
Yeah.
I teach yoga and I teach anatomy and I teach in schools. I'm good at that stuff. But don't ask me to like remember the codes because anything that's got more than three numbers in it, if it's not written down, I'm doomed.
Yeah. So subtly getting the destiny or the... location of another person, finding them and then killing them is not in your wheelhouse.
Oh, God, no. And then if I was captured along the way and they were like, what are you doing here? I'd be like, well, there's this dude. I'm supposed to kill him.
Maybe you're just constantly surrounded by Wonder Woman's magic lasso that makes everyone tell the truth all the time.
When I was a kid, I used to, my siblings used to laugh at me all the time for doing this because I was like, essentially lazy and also aware that I was a kid and not that clever. So usually the interrogations of Amy, you've done something bad, would go along the lines of, Amy, did you do the bad thing? No. Did you do the bad thing? Yeah, okay, I did it.
Yeah.
I was just like, why continue this charade? You probably know I did it anyway.
You're gonna find out. This is just easier for everybody. Yeah, I like that. Our middle child is a little bit like that. He'll do a thing, or there'll be a thing that happens, and I'll just walk in, and I'll just like sort of dead-eye him for a second, and be like, explain yourself, and he'll be like, I'm sorry. So, yeah, okay, good.
Yes. See, his siblings know him as the weak one.
That's right, exactly. Anyway. So... by way of context, just in case I leave that part in because it was a fun little chat. Dear listeners, we had another bout of the old technical difficulties last week.
Oh, and so, dear listeners, mea culpa. My PCM recorder fell off the stool I had it sitting on halfway through the episode. And, you know, I'm a faithful sort of human being. I was like, I'll be fine. It was not fine.
It's not fine. So
no.
If you hear us say things, mysterious things like, oh, like we talked about last time, you are not in fact losing your mind. You have not, to the best of my knowledge, had a stroke recently. It's just that we are operating in a different universe than you, where we've done this before, but this is the first time we've successfully recorded it. Fingers crossed.
And if you did have a stroke recently, get well soon. That's some crazy stuff.
We definitely don't want to make anything worse.
My mom has a guy who comes to do our garden.
Yeah.
And I think she was away on holiday for a couple of weeks, and then she kind of lost track of when the gardener was coming and when the gardener wasn't coming. But he's quite sort of a low-key guy. He'll generally, like, just, you know, he'll rock up and he'll cut the grass and he'll tidy things up, and it's quite a casual arrangement. And the next time she saw him, he said to her, "Oh, I'm sorry I wasn't here last week." And she's like, "Oh, it's cool. I you know, I was away and I wasn't really sure." He's like, "Yeah, yeah, I had a stroke."
Jeez.
And my mum was like, last week? What? So, yeah, it seems that my mum's gardener is just hard as nails.
Yeah.
So if you have recently had a stroke, may your recovery be as swift and smooth as my mum's gardener's.
Yeah. Honestly, though, if I had to pick, like, if I was tasked to generate a character whose primary trait was just utter resilience in the face of physical ailments or challenges or things life throws at them, I might come up with Scottish Gardener. Like, Scottish Gardener would be on my list at any rate.
Yeah.
Given no other restrictions.
Sounds pretty hale and hearty, the Scottish Gardener does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it just sounds like a reasonable, reliable chap.
But this is also, in the interest of full disclosure, this is the first time that we've actually had to do this. We had a technical difficulties affair. Oh, maybe like episode 3 or 4, I think it was.
It was quite a while ago.
And my side didn't record. Who would have thought it was my fault again? My side didn't record, and Ryan suggested, you know, let's just record it again. But I didn't like the word all that much. I felt like it had been an okay word. So we just moved on. And
yeah.
I think you repeated your word at a later date.
I used my word when we recorded last year at Sound Education with Kevin Stroud.
Yeah, that's right.
Adam introduced the word I was doing for that one.
And I never ever went back to shampoo because I didn't think it was that great. So this is the first time that we've had this kind of do-over recording affair.
Because it was quite a fun chat last time. So we're like, yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Anyway, tell me all about Sound Education.
Yeah. Oh, Sound Education was amazing. So we weren't speaking at it this time because the organizers, Sound Education, for people who are new or unaware, is a educational podcasting conference held in Boston for the last 2 years. We were speaking on a panel last year at the inaugural event about podcasting, about language. And this year's language panel was amazing, but the organizers had sort of said, if you could pick different people, so we're only 2 years in, we don't want to have like the same speakers.
Yeah, sure. Also, let's face it, there was some kind of like glitch in the matrix that landed us there last year.
It's true. We
I still find
there.
Myself, you know, if you've seen our Facebook page, the cover photo of our Facebook page is us sitting on that panel, and you can practically see the "how did this happen? What am I doing here?" cloud around me. You know, it's insane. It's still a crazy thing that happened.
It was a lot of fun though, and this year was a lot of fun too. It was really good. It was in a different location, which I wish I had bothered to check before I booked my Airbnb super close to Harvard, where it wasn't this year. But you know, it got me to see more of Boston. But it was a lot of fun. The language panel was amazing. It was organized by Mark Sundaram of the Endless Knot podcast again, and it had Helen Zaltzman, Carrie Gillen of Vocal Fry's, Gretchen McCulloch of Lingthusiasm, and her new book Because Internet, which is amazing. Ray Belli of Words for Granted. And so it was just a great panel. It was about overcoming language myths. And I recorded it. I'm not super happy with Twitter right now because I tried to do this fancy live streaming recording thing. And then Twitter basically grabbed the video and wouldn't let me save it to the phone. And downloading videos off Twitter is ridiculously complicated. So I had someone much smarter than me do it for me. He pirated my own video, which was great. Thank you, Paul. And
God love the internet.
Yeah. But the quality is not great. But all that is to say that there is a video of that whole panel, and we put it up on our YouTube channel. You're just going to have to search Lexitecture on YouTube or go to our Twitter feed where I posted a link, or our Facebook page where we posted a link, because we need 100 subscribers on YouTube in order to have youtube.com/Lexitecture. And I think we're at 68 subscribers now. So anyway, it's there.
Let's all subscribe to Lexitecture twice. You know,
yes.
If you have, you know, I'm sure I've said this before, but I have no fewer than 8 Gmail accounts. I'm sure I could just like
absolutely
bump those numbers up quite a bit just myself by logging in and getting myself a subscribe.
Get that sweet,
with every single
custom
one.
URL. But you can check that out and listen to that panel, and it was great. And the rest of the conference was great. And I met some awesome people. You were sorely missed. Avon, Mark's wife and co-host of The Endless Knot, and generally amazing person in her own right, obviously.
Yeah, she's great.
Tweeted us specifically to, at a tweet directed at you. She knows you're not really on Twitter, but at you saying, we missed you. We had lots of fun, but don't mistake that for us not missing our dear Scottish friend. So you were actively missed, but it was a grand old time anyway. And
good. Good stuff. Did you accidentally drink any more beer that tasted like pudding?
I did. No, not the same. I did have a terrible cocktail. It sounded like it was going to be good.
That's an interesting. You know, I've had some not great cocktails, but I don't think I've ever had a terrible cocktail.
This was legit the first cocktail in my entire life that I just didn't even finish.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was bad. But that was what the was worst part of the whole concert.
Was it like mudstones and vodka?
It was rum and basically Kahlua, like a coffee liqueur, and a maple cream liqueur. And so those three things, I got down that list. I was like, yeah, I'm in for this.
That sounds awesome. I'm here for this. I'm not mad keen on coffee flavored things, but that sounds like those three flavors would go together very well.
Yeah, it also had salt. And I thought that the salt was going to be, hey, we're going to do a clever salted caramel type of like rimming the glass with salt. But it was in the thing.
Oh.
So it was like an April Fool's Day where you have a nice like maple latte, but then someone switches the salt sugar for salt and you dump a little bit of salt. It was bad. Anyway, everything else was amazing. The whole thing was awesome. And we talked about, I did bring up Old Church Slavonic.
Old Church Slavonic.
This is the kind of environment, just so people know how delightfully awesome it is
this,
to be.
This was in the last recording.
Yes.
Nobody knows anything about Old Church Slavonic.
Nobody knows
man.
This yet, but we could. This was an environment where I could talk about, I could mention Old Church Slavonic, and no fewer than 75% of the people around me at any given time would be like, oh yeah, I love that. So the last episode we recorded, we mentioned Old Church Slavonic, and I got really excited and said, man, wouldn't it be awesome if there was one listener out there whose jam is Old Church Slavonic, and they would be extremely happy right now. And then we got probably the greatest email we've received.
Probably
ever?
The greatest email I've received in my entire life.
Yeah, not even just limited to this podcast.
Ryan sent me a messenger message to say, oh my God, look at this! And I was in the process of putting my shoes on to leave my house. And I saw the little preview that said, oh my God, look at this. And then subject, Old Church Slavonic. And I literally like fell over laughing because it was so awesome. And then was late because I was too busy reading about Old Church Slavonic.
That's worth it.
So yeah, Casper got in touch with us about Old Church Slavonic, which was outstanding. And we were just super duper happy about that. I quite love it when you say, imagine if a thing happened and then it happens.
Yeah.
But when it's, imagine if a thing happened that would be really quite niche and quite geeky, and it probably wouldn't make a huge number of people happy, but it would make me super happy.
Yeah.
That was that message.
Yeah, yeah. It was great.
So Casper did mention that he said, would that I could thank you in Old Church Slavonic as well, but all the ways of expressing gratitude in the language fall short of not mentioning some sort of deity of choice. So if really, really religiously heavy ancient languages are your jam, get yourself some Old Church Slavonic.
Yeah, get into that. So I believe that's good for preamble. Would you like to kick this one off?
I believe that's good for preamble.
We're like 25 minutes into the recording. This is the longest
I watched a very funny video on Facebook this week that someone had posted. I can't remember what it was. And the setup was, it was like the inside of a radio studio with a radio host and two guests who had like opposing viewpoints. And rather than actually speaking about a thing, what they all said was, so the conversation started with polite greeting, polite greeting, polite greeting. Intro to radio show, small talk, small talk, small talk. And then, and it was essentially, so one of the guests was reasoned argument, and the other one was, you know, spitting fury, nationalism and shouting louder than everybody else. That was the kind of take, you know, because so many radio phone-in type shows are like that. But yeah, when you say that sounds good for a preamble, I feel a little bit like, okay, small talk complete. Moving on.
Intro accomplished. I think it was Good Omens. It had like a cold open that lasted sort of half the show or something like that. And then
the credits
didn't have the intro yet.
Yeah, the credits didn't actually run until about a good half hour into the episode, maybe even more.
Yeah. Everything about that show was perfect. Anyway.
Oh, it was so great. So, the word I'm going to talk about today, not for the first time, probably not for the last time. And with complete disregard to the liturgical calendar, and you know, I don't know about you, but I love to regard the liturgical calendar.
Absolutely.
The word is pancake.
Hooray.
Incidentally, the liturgical calendar is full of really, really obscure and niche words. You know, I'm not a churchgoer. I'm not religious, but having been raised in, I was raised a Catholic, and the language of organization within the Catholic Church is just, it's fab. You get things like a triduum. Where do you get a chance to use a word like that?
Yeah, not elsewhere. Nearly often enough.
Yeah, just not often enough. And feasts all over the place in the liturgical calendar. So the feast that, the only feast really that many people pay attention to, other than Christmas and Easter, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's funny how all of the feasts that people tend to pay attention to in the liturgical calendar involve food.
Yeah. It's the thing that brings us all together.
The thing that brings us all together. So the word that I'm talking about today is pancake. And pretty obvious etymology. It's made up of pan and cake. Yeah, that's fair. However, the reason that I lit upon this word to talk about was it came to my attention that pancakes are not all created equal. And so in a discussion with Ryan and our other Canadian friend, I realised that the whole vehicle for eating maple syrup that you might consider a pancake to be was not necessarily the same as my Scottish pancake experience. And I explained about drop scones or Scotch pancakes, which as I said, I didn't know they were called Scotch pancakes in the same way that presumably the people in Brazil just call them nuts.
Right.
Drop scones are like North American style pancakes, but they're a little bit smaller, like smaller in diameter and thicker in thickness.
Thicker. Nice. That's,
yeah, I hate to baffle you with pancake terminology, but that's how it goes.
Whoa, slow warm down, doctor. Some of us haven't been to med school.
I'd like to be a doctor of pancakeology.
Yes. You know what? We both are now. We've said it. I think that's all it takes.
Someone on the internet can send us a certificate and that will be a true thing.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
So, yeah, Scotch pancakes are eaten warm or cold with jam and butter. Ryan lost his mind at this. Ryan is not a fan of cold pancakes.
No.
However,
I do like scones though, so maybe if it's closer to scones or scones, however you pronounce that, maybe I would. But yeah, cold pancakes, just that heebie-jeebies me pretty bad.
Yeah, give it a go. I mean, everything still tastes the same. It's just not warm. Although there are lots of food that you could say that about, you know, like, It's fine. Don't worry that your soup is freezing cold. It tastes of all the same things. It's just cold.
That's right.
Yeah. It's not a great argument, Amy. Not a great argument at all.
It's not your best work, but, you know.
So, whether you're talking about drop scones or North American pancakes, or when I was a kid, the other kind of pancake that we ate was what you would probably refer to as a crepe. Or
yes.
A crepe. Scones and scones and crepes and crepes. That's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
But whatever it is that you call them, they're old, old, old. So in the OED, the first written citation referring to a pancake, which the OED defines as a thin, flat cake of batter fried on both sides in a pan.
Mm.
It's from around about 1400.
Wow.
We have alfita. I don't know what alfita is. It doesn't give us any more information than that.
Okay.
Which seems to have been translated or published by Selden, talks about pancakeus with two Ks. And as you would expect from a word that's been around since before spelling existed, there are lots and lots of variants of pancake, pancake as we would see it, pancakes with K's. And the etymology reflects this. So we have pan and we have cake, and I'll talk some more about those in a moment. But we also have other languages that put these two words together. So we have Middle Dutch pankoeke or pannekoeke, Old Saxon panokokkelen, Low German pankoek, Old High German fankoeho, fanakoeho, and no, I'm not having the aforementioned stroke. This one got really, really interesting. And if you want to dive into the incredibly complex word of ablaut vowel variation, you can read about how pancake became fanakuho, as far as I'm rendering it. But frankly, it made me feel a little bit flattened and fried on both sides in a pan. However, the really, really cool thing about pancake, and this feeds back to what we've talked about this so many times, that the OED, God bless it, and its wonderful, wonderful work, gives us the oldest written citation of a word, which doesn't necessarily bear any particular relation to it, how old that word actually is. It's just, A, someone bothered to write it down, B, we still have evidence of the place where that person happened to write it down. And we get a really lovely example of this because, despite the first written sense of the word being given around about 1400, the OED also states that it is apparently attested earlier as a surname. Mark Pancake and Panicak. That's dated as 1283.
So, I had actually forgotten about this.
Yeah, how could you forget about Mark Pancake, ever. Man? Right, give us your two Mark Pancake theories as you did last time, because this hadn't really occurred to me and I liked it a lot.
So first off, one of the reasons this is so hilarious to me is that for a while, one of my best friends back in Korea and bandmates, we had a thing where we would ascribe a first name to a phenomenon and pretend that was the inventor of that phenomenon. So we were playing travel chess and someone bumped the board and the chess pieces didn't move because they were magnetized. And Ike said, thank you, Joseph Magnetism. And so it'd be things like, you know, something would, you'd have a ball that went up into a tree or something and it would fall down. He'd be like, bless you, Hans Gravity. And so the idea that there was an inventor was awesome. I didn't think of that as a pancake. But my two, I can't tell which one I like more or which one I want to be true more, is whether this dude, Mark Pancake, was just, he was named something else and it was pre sort of established surnames anyway. And so he was just wandering along as Mark from Essex or whatever. And he ate himself so many pancakes. That
just
he became
a fiend for the pancakes, just, man.
Yeah. And so people were like, hey, check out Mark Pancake over there. And that stuck. Or that he was some sort of actual inventor of a new kind of thing, and he like a clever marketer, and so he actually if a pancake is actually eponymous and was named after this guy, that would also be amazingly awesome. And I don't actually know which one I want to be true more, but I want one of them to be true.
Well,
really badly.
Listen, in 1283, no one is going to argue about your theory being correct or incorrect. I mean, no. Sorry. Once again, we live in the world of the internet. There is definitely someone out there who would argue with you.
Yeah,
but neither
absolutely.
Of you could possibly be proved right or wrong. So whether you... I mean, I quite like to combine the two. Like, maybe Mark Pancake was the great innovator who first fried batter in a pan. And then so pleased with his new invention was he that he ate so many that everyone was like, whoa, there's Mark Pancake.
Yeah, that's also very good.
It's worth mentioning also that the second citation given in the OED is from around about 1450. And the reason I'm going to mention it is partly because of the wonderful, wonderful resource that you used in our last episode, but also because I know you enjoy hearing me say it's from a cookery book.
Yay!
So, put a little of the white quomad in the pan and late flet à la broad as thou makest a pancake. is what we get in two 15th century cookery books published in 1888, but coming from 1450. And, you know, we get ourselves right down to the 1980s talking about pancakes. People have been eating them and making them and, in my case, wrecking them quite a long time. I'm really, really poor at making pancakes. I always have to go through a few really crappy ones before I then get to this is an acceptable one.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what that's about.
It just takes a while. You know, you're just calibrating.
So Etym Online, interestingly, it mentions that a pancake is used as a symbol of flatness, as in as flat as a pancake, from around about 1600. So not only are they're around enough that they can be used figuratively as well as literally. So on to the pan.
Yes.
A vessel made of metal or, formerly, earthenware, usually broad and shallow and often open, used for cooking and other domestic purposes. Now, what I love about this definition, a shallow vessel, is that it's incredibly broad. It's like, give it a lid, don't give it a lid. Make it of this thing, make it of another thing. Just, you know, it's the cooking thing.
Yeah.
So it does seem that, you know, just as pancakes are quite kind of generic, they can be sweet, they can be savory, they don't cost much to make, but sometimes they're like really luxurious. And, you know, it's a pretty... It's a leveler of a food, pardon the shape pun. So we have, in terms of the etymology of the word pan, cognates with lots of other Germanic languages, pan, pon, and it stayed pretty stable in terms of its form. We have it in Old Swedish, West Germanic languages, Middle Dutch, all of these different places. And Etym Online gives us the very wonderful... pie root. Although this is a bit of an interesting one. So it's believed that the pie root, P-E-T-E or pete, is the origin of the word pan. We also have the vulgar Latin patna, which is apparently from patina, from Greek patan. But there seems to be a little bit of doubt about whether these two etymological roots are in fact related or if they're just one of those, you know, curious coincidences where words that mean vaguely the same thing have completely different etymological, you know, the destination is much the same, but the journey is very, very different.
Right.
So when we look at this pie root, because, you know, it loves me a pie root.
Yeah.
We get... The meaning of the root is to spread. So if you consider the flat base of a pan, something that would be presumably spread out to make it, and also somewhere where you would spread things out, it forms all or part of compass, el paso, expand, expanse, expansion, expansive, fathom, which we've talked about before, mm-hmm. pace, paella, pan, pandiculation, pas, pass, passe, passim, passacaglia, passage, passenger, passport, patten, patent, patina, petal, spandrel, and spawn. It is the hypothetical source of or evidence for its existence is provided by Greek petanine, to spread out, mm-hmm. Old North fathmer, to embrace or bosom, and Old English fathom, to embrace or bosom or fathom. And if you didn't know that the word fathom also, boobs, then go back and listen to that episode because everybody likes hearing about boobs.
Yeah.
That seems to be my take on it anyway.
Yeah.
So then we get to the cake, which Etym Online says comes from early 13th century, flat or comparatively thin mass of dough.
Okay.
OED, however, has a much, much, much earlier citation from around about 1230. So it's conceivable that Mark Pancake was, you know, kicking about when this particular written citation was created. Here, cake burnth o the stan. I do love that the first written citation of cake seems to be about the cake burning. Because, as I mentioned, I did say earlier on in the recording that I was pretty good at cooking. Not so good at the cakes.
Right. Well, baking is a different thing, though.
Baking is a different thing.
Baking is chemistry, and it's weird and finicky and magic.
Definitely, definitely going to take that. But cake, as a I'm having a little laugh here because I was about to say cake also, you know, making its way through the ages. Cake's pretty ubiquitous and it's also quite a generic definition. So OED has it as a comparatively small, flattened sort of bread, round, oval or otherwise regularly shaped and usually baked hard on both sides by being turned during the process. And once again, it's like, is this a cake? Yeah, sure. What about this one? Yeah, yeah, that can be a cake. What about this one? It's made of a completely different set of ingredients and it's a completely different shape. No, it's still a cake.
Yeah, it still so, counts.
Yeah, it very much still counts. What's just occurred to me, which I'm finding slightly hilarious, is that when I was a teacher and I worked in a school, I was in fact, I feel like I've spoken about this before, but I was banned from talking about probably the biggest cake-related cultural phenomenon of the last 15 years. I was banned from talking about the Great British Bake Off. And the reason behind this was, you know, I'd go and sit in the staff room and eat my lunch with a bunch of people. Some of them I knew well and I was friends with. Some of them I didn't know so well. And it's not like I hated their guts, but, you know, they were just people I ate lunch with, whatever. Yeah. But everybody loved the Bake Off. Oh my God, did they love the Bake Off.
Right.
Now, if you love the Bake Off, then that's fine. Good for you. I'm glad that you enjoy it. There's a lot of TV out there that I don't enjoy that other people do. Good. Fine and well. That's how the world goes.
Yeah.
However, I was accused of, quote, sucking the joy out of Bake Off. Because I pointed out one day that I didn't care a great deal about it because it's just cake.
Right.
It's just fucking cake.
Gasp.
Like, I like cake. Cake's generally pretty good. Cake that someone else made for me, that's twice as good at least as the other kind of cake that I had to like buy myself or even make myself.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Like, free cake that someone else made for me. Yeah. Awesome. I would be the worst judge ever on the Great British Bake Off because my response to the hard-earned, you know, difficult challenges that people go through to bake would be, yeah, this is pretty good. Like every time.
Right,
every single time. This is pretty good. Sometimes I might get up to, oh, this is really good.
Yeah.
This is delicious. But I genuinely can't think of a circumstance in my life where I've been served cake and thought, well, this is just dog shit. No more of this. It's awful. I'm not having it.
Yeah. It's like you'd have the extremely rare outliers where something blows your mind or you're sitting there going, did you put shrimp in this? But other than that, it's just going to be like, yeah, it's cake. It's a solid 7 out of 10 every time reliably. Yeah.
But I know that not everybody feels the same way that I feel about cake. Some people get really... It's the whole... It would mean so much to me to win this competition. It would change my life. And you think, would it really change your life? Someone would say officially, publicly on TV, that person there is pretty good at making cake. So yeah, conversations such as this led to me being told, no more, you're not allowed in this conversation.
Talk about it.
Cease. You are sucking the life out of Great British Bake Off. I thought it was very intolerant of them. You know, nothing that I said was untrue. It just didn't fit in with their particular love of cakes.
You know what's amazing though is that this conversation has brought me a great deal of joy, but I 100% see their point.
Like, well, I don't know. I just there's
it's
been
like
cake.
When someone, you know, like non-sports people. It's good that these things exist because it lets sports people understand, like really understand, how little non-sports people care about sports. You know what I mean? Like the existence of a baking show or these other sort of niche reality shows where it's like, look at the dudes making knives. They have 2 hours to make knives. And that's a very niche
thing. Oh, I would be so much more interested in two dudes making knives than a group of people making cakes.
Well, I mean, yes, fair enough, because knives.
Yeah, you've used a poor example there.
But let's stick with cakes then. The cakes thing. Like people, there are people who, like, I suspect you and I, where we enjoy cakes. You can make a really, really good cake. It's hard to make a really, really bad cake.
Yeah.
You know, And but it's not something to get super whatever about either way. And it's that's the kind of thing where non-sports people looking at sports, I think, you know, like they look at the really great achievements. That Kenyan runner who did a marathon in under 2 hours. He ran that's like a 4.5 minute mile 26 times in a row. That's amazing.
Don't even get me started on this because I listened to a podcast this week with Susan Kalman on it and it was quite old. Susan Kalman's a Scottish comedian, and it was recorded the week of Donald Trump becoming president-elect of the United States.
Okay.
And Susan Kalman she's very hilarious, but she was a corporate lawyer and she gave it up to become a comedian. And she's very politically well-informed and you know, she had a lot of really interesting things to say, but she pointed out, it was Richard Herring once again, she pointed out to Richard Herring that she was on tour at this point and she was living by herself. And so she'd had nobody to talk to about all this stuff. She's like, so I'm sorry, it's not funny, you know, none of this stuff is funny, but I need to get it out because it's in there and I haven't had anybody else to talk to all week. Right. And I kind of feel like I live with one other person and he is already sick of me talking about that marathon.
Right.
Because holy crap, he ran a marathon in under 2 hours.
Yeah. So this is the kind of thing, like you're not a huge sports nut in general.
Well, you know, the thing is, this is actually... I hate to, you know, I hate to take the shine off this, but again, I don't feel that this is a great example because while I am not someone who, like, I've never followed a team closely, I don't have a particular sport that I really love and I know all the rules and I follow it religiously, but I also am super duper interested in the human body and particularly in extraordinary achievements with, you know, within that field. So, for example, the Athletics World Championships in Doha were a few weeks ago. I'm not really into athletics. My husband really loves athletics and he would watch stuff like that all day. And I got super duper into it because it's just astonishing watching people have the physical and mental resilience and strength and power to do the things that they do. That's, you know, it's a real reflection of hours and months and years of their life spent not doing fun things just in singular pursuit of this goal. And I think that is an admirable characteristic. You know, I wish I had more consistency and commitment to goals. So when I look at athletes, that's what I see. That's what I enjoy.
Yeah.
And I know that you can also spend quite a long time learning how to make really, really good cake and pastry.
Yeah.
But also, I can make cake and pastry and it's pretty decent, you know, like you follow the recipe and as long as you don't do anything crazy like put shrimp in it, it's probably going to be like, even those first three pancakes that I usually throw away, they don't look very great, but they're still made of the same ingredients and they're still essentially still pancakes.
Yeah, the gulf between you and a professional cake baker is, and I know people are going to argue about this, but is factually and objectively smaller than the gulf between, I won't put this on you, but the gulf between me and someone who can run a marathon in 2 hours, because I'd be lucky if I could run a marathon in 2 days.
Yeah.
And
Eliud Kipchoge is, as far as I'm concerned, he's probably not the same. Like, I thought I was a human being, but if he's a human being, then maybe I'm not, because he is better than me.
Yeah. Just objectively.
Yeah. Yeah, just incredible. Anyway, like I say, I could spend a whole hour talking about this. So, pancakes.
That was a hell of a tangent. Okay, here we are.
Completely forgot that we were talking about pancakes. Pancakes, which, whether you're eating them in Scotland or in North America or in France where they do fancy things to them, you know, whatever it's all about, they're essentially pretty much the same sort of affair. They are spread out in a pan. They have reasonably same sort of ingredients, but my God, they're so influential when it comes to language. So when you look at OED online, you know, you get this little sidebar that tells you about all the other usages of this word, particularly where it's been put into a compound with others.
Right, yeah.
Here are some of the pancake ones. So we have as flat as a pancake, which we spoke about. On pancake wise, pancake batter, pancake breakfast, pancake coil, pancake day, back to the liturgical calendar. Pancake descent, pancake fashion, pancake hat, pancake house, pancake ice, pancake landing, pancake lens, pancake like, pancake making, pancake plant, pancake race, pancake roll, pancake shaped, pancake Tuesday, pancake turner, pancake words, pancake wise, and pancake-ish. Wow. I like I've never seen pancake-ish before.
I like
and then when you take a look at pan and when you take a look at cake, you get just as many, in fact, more in both cases, of these phrasal words. I love that so much of our language has been influenced and spread upon by this pretty ubiquitous, pretty humble, broadly defined, take a flat thing made out of something, put in a batter made of some other things, and do this stuff.
Yeah.
And there you have it. Very simple.
Cool.
Very, very, you know, totally ubiquitous. The last thing that I'm going to say about pancake, I did indeed mention this last time, so please pretend to be as impressed with it as you were genuinely impressed the last time.
Okay.
This comes from Etym Online talking about pan, and I'm really delighted by this because I'd just never considered what this phrase means before.
Okay.
So Etym Online states, the use of pan-shaped parts of mechanical apparatus dates from about 1590, hence flash in the pan. A figurative use from early firearms, where a pan held the priming powder, and the gunpowder might flash, but shot ensue.
Yes, I do. I was really excited when you were like, you need to pretend to be as impressed by this as you were last time. And I was sitting here going, I have no idea what's about to happen. I've forgotten entirely. I don't know what I'm about to hear. And that's amazing. So I am genuinely as impressed because this is like, I mean, it's like reading a mystery novel to a goldfish. It's like, it's always new. Who did it?
So yeah, a flash in the pan.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Like maybe Mark Pancake thought that his invention was going to be a flash in the pan. Although we'd need another almost 400 years to have that particular usage of the word to describe his new innovation that he ate so many of that his neighbours decided that he was to be Mark Pancake for the rest. But
Hello, Mr. Pancake.
I very much enjoy I very much enjoyed having a look at the influence of two very simple things going together to make something delicious.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think one of my favourite, and I don't think I mentioned this last time, but I have a feeling that American listeners, slightly lesser extent Canadian listeners, and possibly UK listeners that don't know that these are different things. Did you know, you do know that flapjacks are pancakes in the US and in some parts of Canada?
Oh, the what now?
Flapjacks?
Flapjacks.
And so you have flapjacks in the UK, right? Is that a Scottish thing or is it just an English thing?
No. We have flapjacks here.
What is a flapjack? To you.
A flapjack is any one of any, it's a pretty generic kind of definition, but if I wanted to make a flapjack, I would get a square tin that was at least a couple of inches deep, and I would put into it probably oats, nuts, fruit, a mixture of that kind of thing, along with something syrupy, sticky, and you don't usually have to cook flapjacks. You mix all the stuff together, you put it in the pan, you cut it into squares, and you eat it just, you know, as you would do any other cake.
Yeah.
So that's flapjacks, what flapjack is, dude.
So flapjacks, yeah, because it's basically like a granola bar.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Is what flapjacks are in the UK. And I remember watching a Twitter exchange where two people were discovering that the same
the
word
other
meant
didn't know
just
that
completely different things, and they didn't realize that, like, the Brit didn't realize that flapjacks were pancakes, and the American didn't realize that flapjacks were granola bars, and it was a wonderful thing to watch.
So why have a different name for pancake if it's, I take it, a flapjack pancake is just exactly the same as any other kind of pancake?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's not as common in Canada. It's more of an American thing. But as far as I know, it's just a synonym for pancakes. It just means a pancake.
Oh.
And I don't know.
I need to look that word up and do some finding out about that.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting
to
see.
That's bizarre.
How that happened, but. But we have it, there's sort of like that with brand names, like certain candies, like in Canada, Smarties are like M&Ms.
Oh, that's the same in the UK.
But in the US, do you have Rockets candies in the UK?
No.
Okay, so we have these little Rocket candies that are kind of like, I guess Sweet Tarts are the closest sort of name, brand name of candy. But anyway,
I have no idea what you're talking about. We need to do at least one episode on different sweets.
Also, we need to do our transatlantic snack exchange again soon.
Oh, yes, we totally need to do the transatlantic snack exchange. Transatlantic snack exchange sound like the kind of band who would support the new pornographers in like a tiny little place.
Yes.
In Saskatoon.
It's such a good band.
Saskatoon's not tiny. I know. Yeah, I meant Saskatchewan. But it's so much fun to say Saskatoon.
Transatlantic Snack Exchange is my new favorite band that doesn't exist. Someone get together, start a band because it's a thing you should do anyway, and call it Transatlantic Snack Exchange. And then
along with
the
Nelson Grelling paradox.
Yeah, send me your SoundCloud because we will share it. I'll share the pants off that SoundCloud. It's so good.
Cool.
Awesome. Pancakes.
Well, remember last week when I was swearing at the universe, having realized that this hadn't recorded, and I said, "Where am I going to find things to say about pancake next time?" Seems like I managed okay.
You did. That was good. It helps that it was all new to me again. very cool. So my word this week, as with last week, is fast. And this one, fast, I thought of as weird when it occurred to me that it has such different definitions, almost opposite definitions. So it's like when an alarm goes off, it can mean that it stopped ringing or started ringing.
I like that.
And I think it's a contronym is the term for that, the word that is its own antonym. There's a word for it. I think it's contronym, which is where Grelling
that
Nelson
that click
paradox
was me hitting the Google.
Yeah. So,
but yes, continue.
Fast is kind of like that because the most common use now is as an adjective, sometimes as an adverb, but it denotes a high rate of speed. You know, quickness of movement. He's moving fast. Cars drive fast. All that stuff. Mm-hmm. But the other uses of it are sometimes the opposite of it. There is the noun meaning where it's like a period where you don't eat for ceremony or religious mm-hmm. or dietary or whatever reasons, but just a period without eating. But the other way is if you're a little more archaic, but it's something that doesn't move at all, as in something is stuck fast or you're held fast to a place. It's the opposite of moving quickly is moving not at all. And so that was like weird to me. That seemed bizarre
sure.
that this word has two opposite meanings, and why does that happen? And so the earliest form, as in the stuck fast, the opposite of quick, is the earliest form as an adjective.
Okay.
Starts showing up in the OED as far back as 888 or thereabouts, AD in a work by King Ealfred of the Anglo-Saxons and West Saxons, who does a lot for the OED. Chaucer and Shakespeare get a lot of, oh, look at these guys with all their contributions to the OED. But King Ealfred, you know, he's sort of the OG dude making up words. And so, shout out to King Ealfred. But speaking of Chaucer, he has come up as is his way. He hilariously, his entry into the OED for fast is dripping with sarcasm from Enelida and Arkite. I don't know. You would think that I would have looked that up and learned how to pronounce that work in the interim time, but I did not. To the surprise.
Would it be an episode of this podcast where one or the other of us didn't go, I don't know how to pronounce this word?
It wouldn't be. But his usage, basically in my adaptation from modern English, is as fast as a rotten mast in a tempest, which is kind of clever. Go Chaucer.
Yeah.
So the OED defines this earliest and longest running usage as meaning firmly fixed in place, not easily moved or shaken, etc.
I love that. It specifically says not easily moved.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the places where this, and this is another thing that I hadn't thought of before, but it's a place where it is used all the time in this incredibly old nigh ancient usage is when you say someone is fast asleep. So there's that that joke that Mr. Smee comes up with in the possibly greatest pirate movie to ever been made, Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman's Hook.
I love that film.
Because it's one of the greatest films of all time. People are welcome to fight me over that.
That film made so little money and it got absolutely panned. I remember going to see it at the cinema when I was but a small wee thing. And I also had it on VHS. It was one of a small number of select titles that I had on VHS. And because it was a small number of select titles, I watched the shit out of that film.
Yeah.
But yes, sorry, Mr. Smee's joke.
It's so good. So Mr. Smee's joke is he opens up. We're going to go back to Fathom again because he opens up. He's trying to rile up the crowd and he's like sort of the hype man for Captain Hook. And he goes, "A man so deep, he's almost unfathomable," which is hilarious. But the pirates all look at him and give him these little blank stares. He's like, "Ugh, a man so quick, he's even fast asleep." And everyone cheers and laughs and it's awesome. So the fast asleep does not, contrary to Mr. Smee's carnival barker aspirations, mean quickly asleep. It means firmly asleep. You know, you're
not
grounded immovably in the state of sleep.
Nice.
And so that's how that goes. And that phrase itself dates back to the late, sort of mid-late 1500s.
Wow.
And it used to be fast asleep, as in three words. And then asleep did its own thing and became one word. But that's neither here nor there. Or it's for later. But this sense of firmness or groundedness, immovability, that type of thing, that makes sense to me. I can kind of mentally get my head around that in the context of not being moved by hunger. Like, I'm so committed to whatever the cause that I'm fasting for that I am able to resist the natural urges to eat.
And when you use it as fasting, that particularly seems to fit into that sense. I'm sticking, I am immovable.
Yeah. And so that makes sense. So to observe a fast, you know, not eating, blah, blah, blah. And
blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. There's also the other thing that came out of OED research on this is that the Old English word is faisten, meaning fortress, cloister, prison, or enclosure. And for varying reasons, food, those don't equate in my mind to places where lots of feasting happens. So if you're referring to a place where food is scarce for various reasons and intentionalities and levels of voluntariness, it's that makes sense that would become adopted into that meaning as well.
Yeah, cool.
There's my folk etymology for the day. What was less clear to me and remained less clear to me is how the word came to mean speedy or rapid. And it makes me feel better that this is also unclear to pretty much everyone else by the look of it. So there's two theories that Etym Online advances. And the first is that it comes from a Scandinavian development of the word's origins and means sort of strongly, vigorously, firmly, etc. And so the idea is that if you say you're doing something fast means you're doing it with vigor and with strength and effort.
Okay.
And so if you're running fast, it means you're running with all your with a maximal effort, which would mean you're running speedily. And so the idea is that's how that transitions.
Not in every case.
Ideally. But more speedy than you would be if you weren't running as fast.
Yeah, sure.
So as fast as you can originally wouldn't have meant as quickly as you can, but as hard as you can, as with as much effort as you can. And the other possibility is that it comes from a branch of Scandinavian related to Old Danish. The word is spelled the same or transliterated the same anyway into English as fast, F-A-S-T, meaning among other things, near to or almost. And so the idea is there that a runner would be fast to their quarry or the thing they were chasing. And so that also implies a certain amount of speed because you're only running if you're trying to catch something that's quick, because otherwise you just walk or stand in front of it. And therefore you must be running with a very high rate of speed as well. And so that would be the idea there. And so I don't know which one of those.
if you're chasing a thing, then you stick to it. Like when you mark a person in a sports game.
It's like, yeah, oh, exactly.
The move.
And so
be fast.
Yeah. And that, so, but it all still comes down to some level of, well, that one's a little bit of a different, it doesn't quite stick as hard to the firm and solid, but the firm and solid is where the pi root for the word comes in. So it's a past with a P, pi root. And this is the source of a Sanskrit word, which we always love to throw in there every now and then when we can. Pastyam, meaning dwelling place. So the place where you are firm and solid. You put down your roots, you're firm and solid in
and
your
you
dwelling
place.
And that's where it comes with the same thing as fast. What I didn't do last time, but I'm going to do now because I was sort of irritated when I realized I didn't do it, is I'm going to consult.
Because you can.
And because I can. I'm going to consult Smith, who has an entry in his
Smith.
Synonyms Discriminated, which
it's been a while.
One of my favorite. It's been too long. Too long. And so Smith is discriminating between fast and firm.
Oh, nice.
And so we talk about how those are synonyms, but as always, Smith is here to be like, not quite. So he says, fast and firm may often be used interchangeably as hold firm and hold fast, but there are other instances which show that firm is a subjective, fast an objective term. So a thing is firm in itself and fast by external fixture. And this is, I'm
love
still
Smith
quoting from him
so
here,
much.
So drive a nail fast into the wall, and it will be firm enough to hang a weight upon it. Hence, firm is used of the internal qualities or substances of things without reference to anything external, as firm flesh, firm ice, and the like. In their analogous application, the same corresponding ideas appear. A fast friend is one who remains steadfastly united and attached. A firm friend is one whose affection is not easily shaken, blah, blah, blah. So you can see how there's a lot of bleed over there still.
Yeah. Do you know, it's probably the first time where I've kind of thought, I don't know if I entirely agree with that, Smith. Like, I wonder where your authority comes from to discern these two words like that. But as usual with Smith, he does it in such a beautifully phrased way that I don't actually care.
Yeah.
He could have made that up entirely. That might be absolute fiction, and I'm still lapping it up. More, please.
Sort of here for it. Yeah. Well, and the other thing he does is he compares fast and hard, which is the same where we talk about the running. You're running hard.
Yeah,
you're
sure.
Fast. So he says, for fast and hard, he says, quote, there is a use of these as adverbs of motion. It rains fast or it rains hard, to run fast or to run hard. The momentum of a moving body is compounded of the velocity and the weight. So fast, to rain fast, denotes the velocity. Hard, to rain hard, denotes, and this is pretty awesome, denotes the weight of the falling liquid. These are not two different things, but the same thing looked at from different points of view.
Oh my God. I heart Smith so much.
Right?
Who thinks about words so that way?
It's awesome. So yeah, so that, and that gets at the same thing, right? If you're running fast, you're running hard, we've lost that difference.
It's the same thing, just looked at from two different ways.
That's where it came from. But it's funny that he talks about comparing those two things and how they are slightly different, but doesn't compare them chronologically because he's not doing etymology. He's doing a form of lexicography, I guess. But it's, so that was interesting. So there's fast.
Awesome. So
the episode it took us longest to finish ever.
I have to point out that you're quite correct. A contonym is defined by Dictionary Online as a word with two opposite meanings, e.g. sanction, which can mean both a penalty for disobeying a law and official permission or approval for an action.
Right.
But
yes.
Wikipedia, the opening paragraph to the entry for Wikipedia, defines it as an autoantonym. Now, there's just so many delicious words here. Listen to this.
Okay.
An autoantonym or autantonym, also called a contronym, contranym, or genus word, genus as in the figure from the underworld who looked forward and back, is a word with multiple meanings of which one is the reverse of the other. For example, the word cleave can mean to cut apart or to bind together.
Stick together.
This phenomenon is called enantiosomy, enantionomy, antilogy, or ought antonymy.
Ought Antonomy.
Oh, squee!
That's all fantastic. I love all those things.
I also, because it was bothering me while I was talking about good old Mark Pancake, Mark Pancake would then be the eponym, as in eponymous, the eponymous word. So Mark Pancake would be the eponym leading to pancakes, which may or may not be eponymous.
Okay, so eponym describes the person it's named after, or the name that it's a thing is named after, and not the thing being named after a person?
So again, Wikipedia is saying an eponym is a person, place, or thing after whom or after which something is named or believed to be named. The adjectives derived from eponym include eponymous and eponymic. Excuse me. Recently, especially in the recorded music industry, eponymous has been used to mean named after its central character or creator. As in R.E.M.'s eponymous album, R.E.M.
That's it. Yeah, because I've been using it in that way for a long time. I didn't actually think, I always thought it meant the thing named after a person, or the word that comes from a person's name rather than the person itself. That's...
Well, technically eponymous does, you know, the eponymous being an adjective. So you would talk about the eponymous pancake named after eponym Mark Pancake. Yeah?
Interesting.
Or am I misreading that?
I don't know. It sounds like, but it sounds like you would say the eponymous Mark Pancake.
The person after whom the thing
but
is named.
But this also feels like one of those things where what's being described as a, here's what it really means and here's what it's used as.
Yeah,
is what
I mean,
a descriptive linguist would say, here's what it used to mean and here's what now it also means.
So except in this case, where it sometimes means this, but only in this part of the world and only when people use it in that particular way.
Yeah,
because like language is fun, folks.
That feels like a prescriptivist, like they're trying to lock in the quote unquote real meaning of eponymous or eponym.
Yeah.
In this other way. But maybe it's not. Maybe I'm just wrong, which is I completely 100% plausible and possible.
It's interesting to have that sense of, you know, who gets to decide what's right and what's wrong. And you can kind of bounce between that, I'm not a prescriptivist, let's let language breathe and move and be alive. And also, but there are no rules for anything, how does anybody know how anything works? You know, so it's I think there's an interesting continuum to kind of surf between those two points without necessarily having to stake your... Well, it's like, you know, I decided to be fascinated with it instead. You don't have to say, I believe this, I think that, and therefore I identify with other people who think that thing and we are now the same. It's just, it's better, really, isn't it?
This has made me infinitely less prescriptivist than I used to be.
Yeah, me too. Although
I
did comment on it was one of these where I commented on a Facebook post this morning. And it was very much, I don't want to be that person, but I am that person.
Yeah.
So, it was a really charming story about a bin man in Tobermory. Tobermory is a town on the Scottish island of Mull. As soon as I've said that, I've instantly doubted that Tobermory is on Mull, because my Scottish geography is crappy. But Tobermory is just... delightful. It's absolutely beautiful. It is on Mull. And this guy who is a bin man on Mull has been taking photographs of what he says is the most beautiful route for a bin man to take anywhere in the UK. And the photographs are stunning, like really, really gorgeous. And so it was a little video from STV, that's Scottish television channel, a little video about this guy and the photographs he's taken. And the video contained, you know, it was one of these sort of mixture of, presumably there was sound, I was watching it without sound, but the words came up on the screen. Since posting the pictures online, they have went viral.
Oh.
And much as I would like to not be the prescriptivist person who says, that's not okay. It's just not okay.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah,
I feel like everyone has their trigger points. Like I
can't be fascinated by that. It's just incorrect.
Now, people can still be wrong about things, though. That's not, this is, it's an overblown slippery slope argument. I did have a lot of fun looking at the comments where I riled people up by posting that article that was written without the use of any apostrophes whatsoever.
Oh, yes.
Advocating for the elimination of apostrophes.
All the strong feelings.
And I love an apostrophe, but I had no idea it would have that much reaction from people. It was really funny.
I don't think we've ever had that much engagement with anything we've posted.
No.
Before
it
that.
Absolutely, the hottest topic thing we've posted.
So there you go, people who are looking for internet penetration. If you want people to really engage with your posts, just tell them that they're not allowed to use a tiny comma-shaped thing and they will go wild.
Yeah. No more sky commas for you.
I love sky commas. That's great. Particularly because I had a wonderful, wonderful English teacher. The now sadly late Barbara Faulkner. She was the sort of teacher who made you want to become a teacher. She was fantastic. And she taught us in S1 English that the way to remember what apostrophes were used for and why they were there was to consider that they were leftover rocket fuel from the letters that had jetted off into space, as in the case of contractions. So isn't and aren't and things like that, the rocket fuel apostrophe remains to let us see that a word used to be there. And yeah, that's, I was probably about 12 when she taught me that, and I remember it as if it was yesterday. So sky commas fits in beautifully with that philosophy.
Awesome. And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon. Ha ha ha!